interrupting the current neo-Yucatan rodeo, climate challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricket Tube Busting Episode BTWRLM 659. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, so get you behind the woodshed. When I located that reference to the university that explained finding that mechanism for how the great Kobe swindle jabs can cause at least myocarditis, and reading between, or skipping, I should say, the safe and effective propaganda, it explains a very, very serious condition that looks fairly systemic to me. It shouldn't be a surprise, as we've been hearing and as I've been reporting. Just looking through this, and so the scientists want to tell us what's up. Stanford Medicine study shows why mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccines can cause myocarditis. Again, skipping through the propaganda just to get to the point of it. We want to see, look at this for ourselves and apply it to our bodies and think that through for ourselves as we decide what we need to do. Stanford Medicine investigators have unearthed the biological process by which mRNA-based vaccines for COVID-19 can cause heart damage in some young men and adolescents, and they've shown a possible route to reducing its likelihood. Using advanced but now common lab technologies, along with published data from the vaccinated individuals, the researchers identified a two-step sequence in which these vaccines activated a certain type of immune cell, in turn riling up another type of immune cell. The resulting inflammation activity directly injures heart muscle cells while triggering further inflammatory damage. Quote, it's not a heart attack in the traditional sense. There's no blockage of blood vessels as found in most common heart attacks. When symptoms are mild and the inflammation hasn't caused structural damage to the heart, we just observe these patients to make sure they recover, one of the authors noted. However, if the inflammation is severe, the resulting heart injury can be quite debilitating, leading to hospitalization, ICU admissions for critical ill patients, and deaths. Quote, but COVID's worse, he added. A case of COVID-19 is about 10 times as likely to induce myocarditis as an mRNA-based COVID-19 vaccination. And how'd they do the test, folks? And this becomes the main problem. And if it's not an infectious agent, since COVID-19 was symptoms, how do they know what they're fighting? That said, let's move on. That's in addition to all the other trouble it causes. Medical scientists are quite aware that COVID itself can cause myocarditis. Well, those were symptoms again. Let's just broach the infectious agent, which wasn't a natural infectious agent. It was the jab itself, given the novel nature, the lab-made nature of the spike protein that was then encased in lipid components to get past your bodily defenses. But they knew. They were quite aware. It's the shocking thing I came across right there on this whole story, actually. To a lesser extent, so can the mRNA vaccines, but they don't make a distinction here. They can't. And this is the whole point about the propaganda. The only way there could be a vaccine is if COVID-19 had an infectious agent that was natural. And where do I get that? All of y'all that done the research and study yourself know that it's a communicable disease law, locally, anywhere. The question is why? Two proteins named CXCL10 and IFN gamma popped up. We think these two are the major drivers of myocarditis, Wu said. They operate like a tag team. CXCL10 and IFN gamma both belong to a class of proteins called cytokines, signaling substances that immune cells secrete to carry on chemical conversations with one another. Hoping to listen in on these communications, the scientists generated human immune cells called macrophages, fierce first responder cells of the immune system, in a dish and incubated them with mRNA vaccines. Again, I can't read that without having to make this exception. They're not vaccines. This is gene therapy technology. This is not a vaccine. And you know that if you go read your communicable disease law, and they'll define what a vaccine is, and it can't be lab-made. There's just no way. It has to be a natural infectious agent that has to be identifiable. They don't have a test for that. The macrophages responded by pumping out various cytokines, but mostly notably pronounced amounts of CXL10. When the scientists further supplied this dish with an additional kind of immune cell, a T cell's roving sentinels that can recognize and mount immune attacks on specific pathogens, but can also incite general arousal of the immune system, or even when they merely steeped T cells in the solution in which the vaccine-administered macrophages had bathed, they saw a marked uptick in the T cell's output of IFN gamma. But did the two cytokines together contribute directly to cardiac injury? And I need to interject, as you're looking at this with what Sound Minds might be doing on one of the videos, or you read it yourself, I'm jumping through this, again, cutting out all the propaganda they threw into this webpage here from Stanford. But did the two cytokines work together? Yes. CXCL10 and IFN gamma did contribute directly to cardiac injury in these mice that they used. And checking that and blocking them largely preserved the immune response to the vaccination while lowering levels of cardiac troponin induced by vaccination. It being only a hunch by Wu, and because it sounds like something out of a sustainable development goal, I'm not going to read what he thinks will prevent the damage. And if you're interested in what he hunches, get the link in the blogcaster and read through this for yourself. So you can, again, get the bodily situation going on. But what seems apparent to me is to prevent the damage, don't let anyone jab you with a proprietary substance that the law defines as a bioweapon. That wasn't even mentioned, was it? And moving on through, also, we had a vitamin D mistake. I hope some of you picked up that and read on that and did some more research about it. We have a follow-up on now omega-3. On omega-3, we need to close the gap. Experts call for clear guidelines as they find most people aren't getting enough of the fatty acids. So this is, again, we are at the point where the government gives us the wrong numbers and we meet them and they're not near enough to give our bodies what they need in order to do their own self defenses. Most people on the planet aren't getting enough omega-3, according to an analysis out of the UK that found 76% of the global population is falling short of the recommended daily intake. The review conducted by researchers at the University of East Anglia and University of Southampton and health retailer Holland and Barrett is the first to compile national and international omega-3 guidelines for general healthy people across all life stages. And boy, they sure nailed a lot of us who would say, go to fish oils, eat your omega-3s, raise them up, raise the Ds. They're after the fact they're coming on, and I think this is on purpose, to let us know again. This is Noostis. They're totally giving us notice what might work for us and where our problems might be. And I suggest that might be to set us, they're letting us know now so that there's no excuse when they bring it on to us again. Some other thing. Researchers say that the health benefits of omega-3 fatty acids like EPA and DHA are well established, ranging from supporting infant development and reducing the risk of preterm birth to improving heart health and lowering the risk of depression and cognitive decline later in life. The research published in the Nutrition Research Review journals points to a mismatch between public health guidance and what people actually consume. Very similar to what happened in the vitamin D. They also note that the recommendations themselves are inconsistent and confusing the world over. To close the gap, we need easier, sustainable ways to get these important nutrients, like foods enriched with omega-3s or supplements, says the University of East Anglia's Anne-Marie Minihane. The most commonly recommended intake for adults is 250 milligrams per day of combined EPA and DHA, with pregnant women advised to get an extra 100 milligrams to 200 milligrams of DHA. The recommended levels can be met by eating more oily fish and taking supplements though the researchers acknowledge that dietary preferences of sustainability concerns can get in the way. Why is that getting in the way? Because climate change is not about the weather. Nutraceutical Business Review, a different recent study, found that the higher omega-3 levels have been tied to a reduced risk of suicidal ideation. You know, just think back of all the stories we've had about suicides and increased suicides, and we look back at our diet, we've been told it's okay, but it's not. It's not at all, and I've got to say that's got to be by plan. And so I include the link that they refer to in that story. You can get the link at the Blogcaster, and you'll find the link in the first article, and I bring it along in the study, reference study. The referenced study is the association between plasma omega-3 fatty acids and suicidal ideation, self-harm, in the United Kingdom Biobank. And so very interesting deficiencies come up in our food sources that are causing a lot of the problems that we have. And the goings-on ramping up in the Caribbean Sea, ostensibly against Venezuela. I ran across a post listing some of the CIA projects which help inform anyone interested of the goings-on of the United States government. And this is from Geo Gaganots, and a couple of different posts I ran across. Very interesting things they pulled together. And in this case, you get the link. You also get the links to every project that they have identified for us, if we didn't have them before, posts that they've made throughout the years, I suppose, about what the U.S. military and CIA do around the world and to us at home. And that's really more my concern at some point, as I keep talking to us about perception management. But we spent the last months diving deep into illegal operations of the CIA, the U.S. military, and the U.S. government. All of the following are authentic, documented, and officially declassified events. The titles are clickable, so you can follow the links and read more. And I'll just go through the list, and we can hear the names and see what they're doing, what's going on. And I'm bringing this up because it's, you know, we're not the white hat that we think we are, and I think that's important for people to start understanding, truly understanding deeply what's going on, getting beyond what we're told, and kind of allows us to drop our guard a lot of times and not insist on what we really need to see. MK Ultra, CIA mind control experiments on civilians. Operation Delirium, the U.S. military subjected to harmful biological agents. GI, your government issue, they can do whatever they want to you, I suppose. That's proof. Operation Fishbowl, reckless nuclear tests in upper atmosphere. COINTELPRO's FBI's illegal surveillance and sabotage of activists. MK Naomi, CIA's biological warfare research on civilians. Operation Chaos, CIA's illegal surveillance of anti-war Americans. And if I just jump back to that last one, biological warfare research, what do you think the Greg Comey swindle was? And Sasha Latapova has the receipts. She has all the contracts. Told us all about it after the fact. Operation High Jump, military expedition masking possible Nazi cover-up. Operation Mockingbird, CIA's control over media for political manipulation, which the Congress instituted a modernization of to remove the block against being propagandized to in the Smith, modernizing the Smith-Mundt Act. That act modernization was 2012. Operation Northwoods, U.S. military plan to stage false flag attacks. Operation Paperclip, U.S. protected Nazi war criminals for scientific gain. Project SEAL, secretive testing of underwater explosives. Operation Stargate, $20 million in a secret psychic warfare program. Operation Popeye, manipulation of weather during the Vietnam War. Project Artichoke, how long did it take to choke Artie? Really thought about it too much. Turning unsuspecting people into programmable agents. Wasn't I just listing the Charlie Kirk Memorial just a couple episodes ago? Further investigations by Gaganots of Geopolitics will cover Project Bluebeam, Project Bluebird, Project Blue Book, Project Coast, Project Groom Lake, Project Monarch, Project MUDHEN, Project Rainbow, Operation Ranch Hand, and Project Woodpecker. These programs involve mind control experiments, biological weapons development, large-scale disinformation campaigns, and more. Just to keep us up on what's going on relative to the nuisance that we observe and what it might be doing to us. And I think it's important to be reading some of these, well, actually everything when you can get your hands on, to find out what their focus and target was, what they learned, what they might be adapting. And then you, once you see that, once you know, you're much better prepared to start identifying it. And that's the big deal in my mind. We'd be able to look out and identify maybe what would not have been identifiable by us before that. And not included in that list, but worth mentioning relative to things learned toward enhancing perception management, that Project Bluebird, CIA's first brainwashing game, and it wasn't included in the list, but they're going to work on. In the early 1950s, the Cold War paranoia gripped Washington. The rest of the United States didn't care, I suppose, but gripped Washington. The CIA rolled out a secret initiative known as Project Bluebird, a chilling attempt to crack open the human mind for intelligence exploitation. Its roots lay in the World War II, when the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, and the CIA's wartime precursor experimented with the truth drugs like scopolamine and mescaline, along with hypnosis and psychological manipulation to pry confessions from prisoners. Here's how Bluebird turned the crude experiments into a systematic program. Or is that program? They sold as a defense against alleged communist, quote, brainwashing. It quickly became an offensive campaign to break human resistance. Under the cover of a polygraph interrogations, teams of psychiatrists, hypnotists, and technicians ran experiments designed to erase willpower and extract compliance. And when I read that, I just think about the internet and about every web page you go to could be doing this to you. And I think those are highlighted in those tests that they'll offer us to take from time to time if we'll choose to click on it. And there's a whole thing behind all that as well. This is not even new. I've talked about a lot of this as well. But the thing is be careful we don't pigeonhole our minds into these other people that are doing it to us. The internet is that tool, essentially put into digital form for our acceptance. Subjects were routinely drugged, hypnotized, and psychologically tortured, often without consent. Interesting, they flipped that script on you, didn't they, when they gave you your phone and your internet, didn't they? The records that were buried or destroyed but declassified materials of investigations revealed bits of the human wreckage left in its wake. One victim was Frank Olson, a U.S. Army biological scientist covertly dosed with LSD by CIA operatives as part of the tests. 9 days later, he plunged from a New York hotel window, his death officially labeled suicide, but disputed by his family or forensic evidence. Maybe he should have had more omega-3s. Bluebird's evolution into Project Artichoke and then MKUltra expanded the horror. Under MKUltra, the CIA continued to dose unwitting civilians and prisoners with LSD using sensory deprivation, sleep, torture, and psychological stress across universities, hospitals, prisons, and I'll say the internet now. In one prison experiment, the doom scrolling come to mind here, folks? One prison experiment, inmates received daily high dose of LSD for months, triggering paranoia, hallucinations, and a mental collapse so severe inmates reported walls bleeding. And so now we have AI taking on the role of some LSD-addled patient. Many subjects were prisoners, psychiatric patients, and civilians, chosen precisely because they were powerless. Declassified fragments. Now, I just read this stuff. Just think about what people, you see people responding to the internet and social media and all the, whatever's going on. I see it written right in these words that this is an open experiment and we have been brought powerless to a lot of things. Not just about the web, the internet, the interwebs, but life. Declassified fragments suggest long-term psychological harm in at least 20% of those tested. Project Bluebird, another proof the CIA's deadliest weapon wasn't secrets, but systematic abuse of human minds. And for those thinking, well, I'm not on LSD, be careful what you think an altered reality might be to cause you to react to, especially when your reality has been perception managed to this point, and you haven't identified to what extent the trip you're on, right, Mr. Leary? And then they get you, or the entire government, to rely on AI, which hallucinates, coming out of the modeled LSD-influenced and addicted black box that they hand you. Right, Alice? And in keeping pace with all the peace success, not success, from the U.S. Department of International Piracy, Trump says the U.S. has seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela. President Donald Trump said Wednesday that the United States has seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela as tensions mount with the government of Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro. Using U.S. forces to seize an oil tanker is incredibly unusual and marks the Trump administration's latest push to increase pressure on Maduro, who has been charged with narco-terrorism in the United States. The U.S. has built up the largest military presence in the region in decades and launched a series of deadly strikes on alleged drug smuggling boats, again, alleged drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean. Quote, we've just seized a tanker on the coast of Venezuela, a large tanker, very large, largest one ever seized, actually, Trump told reporters at the White House. Trump said, quote, other things are happening, close quote, but did not offer additional details, saying he would speak more about it later. The seizure was led by the U.S. Coast Guard and supported by the Navy, according to a U.S. official who was not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on conditions of anonymity. Is that a court-martial or something if you get caught? But from the look of the video I saw, there was no Coast Guard in sight, but the Marines rappelling from choppers onto the tanker was also Israeli-esque when they descended upon the humanitarian aid boats in Gaza. It's just like that. But as to a humanitarian purpose, I understand that there is a good chance the cargo was from both Venezuela and Iran that was headed to Cuba to fuel the only power plant providing electricity to the people of Cuba. So clearly, even if this oil was being meant for refining to produce needed distillates, this is not about drugs. Trump is a thug pirate. But I understand being Cuba produces sugarcane, lots of sugarcane, sugarcane like lots, a very large amount, right, Trump? Very large, very much. And the United States just outlined corn syrup. Military buildup might be for a much larger theft and control of natural resources in that whole region. As I've been saying, there's more going on, all of which are war crimes, as well as to solidify the drug monopoly of the Mos Sayyid La Cosa Nostra syndicate cartel in the region. Right, Colombia and Mexico? And I also realized a few days after that notice of the tanker being taken by the United States, Maduro came out and said they emptied that tanker a couple days before it got taken. And all that oil got sent to Cuba by different ships. So I thought that was pretty slick in what they're doing. And in fact, Maduro did something else. He's escorting ships out now with his Navy. And that puts all the onus now on the United States to determine whether or not they want to take any act now that would cause a declaration of war. So there's some high stakes at one regard if this is not a setup between the two. And as I say, Maduro already gave up, said he would give up all the stuff that Trump's asking for. Something's not right here. Maybe it's just that Trump's not too stable. I don't know. He's going to make a point of everything, doesn't he? And because if it's also correct what is coming up, Maduro that tried to give those natural resources to the United States, which I've already openly reported behind the woodshed a couple episodes ago, Maduro has expressed trust in Turkey's President Erdogan, adding to the speculation about his possible refuge there. I think this is more of a propaganda, but it's interesting when we don't hear too much on the surface. There's other things going on, and there was discussion, and I think it did come from Maduro, that he would be willing, if you're going to protect the country, to make better arrangements. But even That all was not enough for the Manhattan wise guy. Zio Mueller indicates this is a much bigger geopolitical plunder by the peace faker in chief, leading a failing empire to control everything close to its quickly diminishing realm. To extrapolate that consideration out, even to de facto claim to extend the territorial waters within which the United States Coast Guard operates 1,500 miles south in an attempt to legitimize the illegitimate. And by that extension, therefore, claiming de facto possession or control of at least northeastern South America. Are you listening, Brazil? And oh, Brazil just popped up in the news, starting to talk all of a sudden. The officials added that the seizures are conducted under U.S. law enforcement authority. Otherwise, can someone explain to me how an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela is within the territorial waters of the United States for purposes of U.S. law enforcement activity, ostensibly to stop small-time drug running? Because it sounds to me like not even the Coast Guard knows the answer. The seizure comes a day after the United States military flew a pair of fighter jets over the Gulf of Venezuela in what appeared to be the closest that warplanes had come to the South American country's airspace since the start of the administration's pressure campaign. Trump has said that land attacks are coming soon, but has not offered any details on the location. It was not immediately clear who owned the tanker or what national flag it was sailing under. Coast Guard referred a request for comment to the White House. So, who Maduro going to call? Venezuela accused the United States of committing an act of international piracy and called it on the international community to condemn the seizure of its oil tanker by the U.S. military, the country's foreign minister said. The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela strongly denounces and condemns what constitutes a blatant theft in an act of international piracy. Venezuela calls on all Venezuelans to stand firm in defense of the homeland and urges the international community to reject the vandalistic, illegal, and unprecedented aggression that seeks to normalize itself as a tool of pressure and plunder, the ministry said in a statement on Wednesday. So we hear the two positions being laid out here. As I'm thinking about this as well, we understand this oil is an interesting problem if they're after drugs, and I don't mention it too much, but in a conversation I might talk about here in a little bit, the idea, remember I've talked about Mikado, now she's peace faker again, she's a peace prize winner, now calling for it again, some more attacks, but remember she was in close intimate communication with Israel, and I think a lot of this, because of the undue influence that Trump allows around him by the Zionist Federation Movement political party, I think we're not hearing much at all about it, but I think we may be hearing something like the MEGA group being involved in this down and through as this goes along, and why Trump is so adamant about it as well. Whatever his statements are, that's not really how this is playing out. Caracas noted that the U.S. president publicly admitted to attacking the Venezuelan tank in the Caribbean Sea, called the move part of a long-term strategy to plunder the South American country's resources. The Venezuelan government reaffirmed that, quote, it will appeal to all existing international institutions to denounce this serious international crime and will defend its sovereignty, natural resources, and national dignity with absolute determination, the statement said. If genocide in Palestine is any measure, Maduro is yelling into the ocean breeze, calling the sirens of the sea. This is a very interesting geopolitical dynamic being built right here. I'm going to be interested to watch how this plays out, and whether or not Trump is, again, just looking like the big gorilla runs in your face, stumped on his chest, and then he's not going to do much. Not going to really follow through. We'll see about how that goes on. But right on cue, President Trump orders Venezuela blockade. He says that there will be a total complete blockade of sanctioned oil tankers. I found that statement limitation very interesting. But a complete blockade. President Trump said he's tightening the screws on Venezuela's oil trade and slapping a terrorism label on its rulers while he's at it. Well, again, you can allege all kinds of stuff, and we can call them, we cannot agree with them, but if they have a democratically elected government, our dispute means nothing. It's their people that have to take care of it. And so he's exchanging their rights for his, and he has no right to do that as well. But so, okay, now we have a narco-terrorist and a terrorist on all the rulers of Venezuela, and I think we need to look at our own glass house before we start throwing so many stones. In a Truth Social post Tuesday, the president said he designated the Venezuelan regime as a foreign terrorist organization and announced that what he called as a total and complete blockade for all sanctioned oil tankers going in and out of the country. And so here we have, he is making the determination. I said, be reflective of that on inside the gates for the homegrown. And this won't be just Trump. This will be anybody with the power to make a call, to call you a name, as I've talked about plenty of times over the years, that they did to people. They're already doing it to people, extremists here in the United States, sovereign citizens, all this type of thing. It's really just projection of their criminality. And when you start to really see that, and you realize, and you then add the additional condition that you're the occupied people, that I hope would make you think and cause you to think a little differently, to approach things differently. So he's going to put all this on him, but that's not all. Venezuela is completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America. Does this guy know geography? It's not an island. Quote, it will only get bigger and the shock to them will be like nothing they have ever seen before until such time as they return the United States of America all of the oil, land, and other assets that they previously stole from us. Venezuela stole their oil and land and assets from us, the U.S.? Sounds like Satan Yehu, doesn't it? How does that happen? How does Venezuela steal its own oil and land and assets from the U.S.? The pirate plunderer-in-chief doesn't explain them. What he says is further down in this post is, we'll not allow a hostile regime to take our oil, land, or any other assets, all of which must be returned to the United States immediately. So his official statement in the Truth, well, unofficial statement in Truth Social, see, that's his other angle, says our oil. Then whose heating oil did Venezuela, through its fuel company Citgo, give to needy folks starting in the Bronx but expanding and donating more than $100 million worth of fuel to the neediest families in 23 states across the United States to approximately 100,000 Americans for free under Hugo Chavez, if that's United States oil? Trump said the regime has been designated a foreign terrorist organization for the theft of our assets and many other reasons, including terrorism, drug smuggling, and human trafficking. That sounds just like a piling on of a local prosecutor's charges, doesn't it? Trump's declaration comes a week after the U.S. seized a tanker off of Venezuela's coast, part of a broader pressure campaign on President Nicolas Maduro's government, which Trump has long accused of enabling narcotics flow to the United States. Again, accused without conviction. He didn't define what he meant by sanctioned tankers, and it's not clear how many tankers will be affected. But he doesn't define anything, actually. But by U.S. law, Trump's regime is terrorism. Speaking hours before Trump's post, Maduro accused, quote, imperialism and the fascist right, close quote, of seeking to dominate Venezuela and strip it of its oil, gas, gold, and other resources, vowing to defend the country and predicting, quote, peace will triumph, close quote. I don't understand how these leaders actually think, but that's maybe why I'll never be a leader. Is that true? Is that why that is? Peace will triumph through defending yourself from some aggression. Trump has said the military buildup in the Caribbean and military strikes on alleged drug boats are part of a campaign to stop drugs from reaching the United States. Okay, why'd you attack and seize an oil tanker then? And what if the boats they blew up were human trafficking boats? More innocent people deserve to die due to Trump's delusions here? Is that what we're hearing? In an interview published in Vanity Fair on Tuesday, however, his chief of staff, Susie Wiles, suggested the goal was regime change, saying Trump, quote, wants to keep on blowing boats up until Maduro cries uncle. I suppose that's Uncle Sam, right? But guess what? He's already called Uncle Sam, and he gave him everything, monopolized. He was going to give him a monopoly, and that wasn't good enough. And what else if it isn't regime change? Then Trump is attacking the population of Venezuela. And then America plans to do regime change to how many South American and North American countries, because those countries have stolen our oil, land, and resources, and what all? While it's not fully clear what stolen oil and land the president is referencing, Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez, nationalized some oil fields and essentially took over stakes from foreign companies like ExxonMobil. Venezuela has the largest known oil reserves on the planet, producing roughly 1 million barrels a day, though Venezuela has been largely cut off from global markets due to U.S. sanctions. Venezuela went on to slam Trump's naval oil blockade as a violation of international law, developing that aspect of it. Venezuela has expressed outrage as the United States President Donald Trump's announcement of a naval oil blockade, quote, with an aim of stealing the riches, close quote, that belong to the Republic. So we understand this natural resource. I've talked about this a long time. I talked about it with Israel even taking gravel from Palestine is a war crime. And this is what's going on here. But Trump's claim, those are ours, not theirs. But Trump also hadn't done what he needed to make a claim. And those of you with property, consider this as a challenge for your congressionally granted land. What would Trump or anyone have to do to claim your property? And would threatening your property with his gang of marauders make his claim any more valid? So why does he think that it's okay to do that to a sovereign? And how does doing so make America great again? Does this bring peace on earth or goodwill toward men? Any attempts by the U.S. to block oil tankers entering or leaving Venezuela constitutes a violation of international law, stated Venezuelan Vice President Delcy Rodriguez. Quote, Venezuela, in full exercise of international law, our Constitution, and the laws of the Republic, reaffirms its sovereignty over all its natural wealth, as well as its right of freedom of navigation and free trade, the government said in a communique. And so again, like Russia, they're laying out what they have a right to do and what's being interfered with. And I want you to listen, my listener, to put this on you. If you consider yourself autonomous and self-directing, and you have a will and a choice, don't you have these rights as well over your piece of land? Do you have the freedom of navigation and free trade? Well, of course you don't. You'd laugh at me when I said that, didn't you? But we should. And we ought to, and we've kind of walked away from that, and that's what they expected. But this is nothing new, actually, from the U.S. government at all. Doesn't matter what administration's in the way. Venezuela rejects Trump's grotesque threats, vows to go to the U.N. Again, who are you going to call? I mean, part of this is really water under the bridge already. It's useless, but it sets up a dynamic, and it's getting serious. And so this kind of comes up. At some point, people may start dying. You have to kind of ask yourself, is that what we really wanted? Is that really what we need? In an official communique, Venezuela accused Trump of treating its oil, land, and mineral wealth as U.S. property. So all of it, I've been talking about property all these years and decades and why it was so important. We can go right down through the list. I won't do it here. I'm hoping you will. What is U.S. property? And is it at the place called Venezuela? And consider the difference between a property and an interest, and then an interest by what agreement, and then the jurisdiction of that agreement. The statement added, Venezuela will never again be a colony of an empire or foreign supposed power. The authorities reiterated that the true intention of America's leader has always been to appropriate the country's oil, land, and mineral resources through large-scale campaigns of lies and manipulation. And I'm just going through some of these lists. I'm hoping that we, as we listen in, we're listening to someone who has the wealth, who has the land in their territory. They're asserting their rights, and they're claiming, again, and this is one of the other observations, the one who's being trespassed has every power and right to make the determination of how they're being harmed, not the aggressor, as I see going on in lots of other places. And so this is another thing we're listening for, and we have the ability, I would hope, to listen to what their claim is and then qualify what they're saying. And we assess whether or not the United States can make these claims. Put Trump aside. Can they make these claims? Venezuela vowed to act in strict accordance with the UN Charter, quote, fully exercising its freedom, jurisdiction, and sovereignty in the face of these belligerent threats. So let me throw out this other point. We're talking about now special words in a way. They are in international law. They're in admiralty. They're in the words of war, in terms of war. And so this is not a small thing when we read these. We just think they're just words on a statement. No, these are very serious and directed statements that need to be paid attention to and qualified. As I'm reading through, I don't think they're making misstatements. I haven't seen all the proof, but I'm going to accept that their borders are theirs, their territorial waters are theirs, the minerals in the land is theirs. And if Trump had a problem, he should have went to a court of competent jurisdiction, I would think, because I think we'll come on to that in a moment. U.S. President Donald Trump said Washington has ordered a total and complete blockade. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump said Washington? The district did that? Clearly, Washington, D.C. didn't do a thing here. And this is the thing about not taking responsibility and diverting our attention to some other thing that we think it has validity. What's Washington's claim now? See, everybody, you go to the property. This is what I tell you. Follow property. Like, follow the money. Follow the property. Follow the title. Follow it. Get the evidence. Figure it out. And you'll see real quickly who has stuff and who don't. Who has the cards and who don't. Who has the top property, who doesn't. Washington doesn't have title here either. But we're going to, again, sanction all the tankers entering and leaving Venezuela, accusing Caracas of using oil revenues to finance crime and terrorism. Okay, where's his court case? That's an allegation. Where's the court of competent jurisdiction? And if you found someone that was doing that and you made that complaint, would you be able to start bombing their cars and their property and stealing their stuff? Killing their people? Come to visit you? In a truth, a social post, Trump claimed Venezuela is completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America and said Maduro's government has been designated a foreign terrorist organization. And so everyone's going to just point their finger. Every nation now is a foreign terrorist organization. I guess everybody could do that. It would fit the United States fairly well, I think. So again, we live in a glass house. We need to either change the glass for something more substantial or just clean house and not worry about it. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's what has to happen. On Tuesday, the Venezuelan government filed a formal complaint with the UN Security Council accusing the United States of a serious act of involving the use of force, kidnapping, and piracy in international waters in the Caribbean. The complaint was submitted by Venezuela's permanent representative to the UN, Samuel Moncada, and I would just suggest that you see that they're a nation of within the nation within the UN. So there's supposed to be some more oversight than what Trump is actually using and doing. And it would seem to me if he had actual title, they could have proved it already, and they haven't. And remember, this is not some short time. This is over 50 years for Venezuela. But this should have been taken care of by the United States, not during Trump. Venezuela oil blockade could make Asia's markets less dependent on the U.S. So here we have another, again, looking at how this thing works in the world, and then always holding out in your mind, this is a plan, possibly, to make it this way. We see what happened to Russia, and they went and they did what they did. Almost the same reaction is going to happen in this case as an analyst goes through and suggests that because of this strife, because of the weaponization, it drives people away, nations away. They'll find and work out other ways. One of the goals of the United States-led oil blockade on Venezuela is to try to weaken President Nicolas Maduro politically while hoping to create divisions within the country's political elite, says Dr. Vinicius Vieira, Associate Professor of Economics and International Relations at the Armando Alvarez Apuntiado Foundation, FAAP. When it comes to economic terms, quote, the misery of the Venezuelan people is likely to increase due to the U.S. naval oil blockade, Mr. Vinicius Vieira tells Sputnik, given that the country essentially depends on oil exports. So my statement earlier, a couple of tabs ago, was not off the mark. Is Trump actually attacking the people? And this is another political ploy by the CIA would pull off. It's not right. It's not how you're supposed to do this if you're up and up, if you're the white hat. So this is an implementation, really, by Trump, by the United States, the first rule of international law for any ruler, which is don't piss off the natives. So a potential invader wants to get the natives pissed off at the ruling government to help oust the ruler to gain control. And it's what the CIA does in its color revolutions, like the U.S. did in the Ukraine to go after Russia. And that's another, like a billiard game there, isn't it? And so we see the earmarks, the model working. But you see how well that works out after a while against someone that can defend themselves. And it took a little while before Russia was able to get itself in order, and it has. And now Trump has no cards, and they didn't get what they wanted, and Russia's not going anywhere. However, always keep open this other potential. This is what the way the future that they want wants it. They are bringing parity, and this is the way the strife, the chaos, they are able to pull this together, as the title says. The oil blockade could make Asia's markets less dependent on the U.S., but you see how well that works out against someone that can defend themselves. And it's what the government of the United States thwarts in America to get and keep the natives pissed off at each other so they don't direct their pissoffedness at the government, which government itself may exist in layers to thwart initial ire at the government. One of the first ones that they use is to blame a politician or a branch of government so as to insulate the rest and let the natives expend their energy fixing so-called the problem, leaving the untouched governance to continue to occupy the natives as they are calmed down, and thereby complying with that first rule of international law concerning any ruler, which is don't let the natives get pissed off at you. Pissed off isn't a four-letter word, is it? No, I hope not. Good. It's a family broadcast. Well, moreover, what concerns global oil prices, there may be an impact on the oil markets, given that Venezuela holds the largest oil reserves in the world, says Dr. Vieira, who is also a lecturer of international relations at the Getulio Vargas Foundation in Brazil. Well, here we are. Given Venezuela's major economic partnerships and the countries that rely on oil exports, quote, one can expect impact to those markets. Venezuela ships oil to China and other Asian markets that are less and less dependent on the United States, and that may trigger some instability. We will defend our people because our people have the right to their land, their wealth, and their homeland, said Maduro. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro told members of his government that the country is a humble and battle-hardened people who we cannot fail. And so now the rhetoric starts from internally to bring cohesiveness back to the people, as this looks like it is an attack right on the people. Considering that China is Venezuela's largest creditor and a major oil buyer, one can anticipate a degree of backstage diplomatic engagement between China and the U.S. quote, to mitigate any potential effects of this blockade, speculates Dr. Vieira. Speculates. Could be. That's right. And maybe not. Nevertheless, China is the largest creditor. It's no surprise that Trump's year-end speech skipped Venezuela entirely, believes the pundit, since he focused on issues easier for the American public to grasp. Trump basically covers all updates on what is going on in terms of military operations targeting Venezuela in his social media posts, quote, making a formal mention redundant. He notes, adding, so that's why when Trump didn't prioritize Venezuela or international issues in general, apart from tariffs. Make it easier for Americans to grasp. You're so intelligent, see, folks? And apparently Trump knows that. So I'm not quite so sure that it's exactly true that he would do that, make it informal instead of being formal. But let's go with that discussion. My discussion here is to observe from the Neustis, among other things, is the very first thing being done out there is the continuing thing they are doing to you at home right here. How are you being played, perception managed, to defeat you? Relative to the story, people need energy. Nations will continue to work around the obstructions best as they can. The U.S. wants to control that energy at the expense of other peoples and nations. Just the tanker embargo is a war crime when interfering with the natural resources of a nation and an act of war precluding Trump ever being considered a peacemaker or fulfilling his promise to stop wars globally, in which the Republican Party agrees with, having failed to pass legislation to stop Trump unilaterally continuing his warmongery. And as I touched on over the last couple of episodes in particular with the new national strategy document, the apparent death throes of an empire in decline, the U.S. may turn Venezuela into a powder keg. Now we're moving to a more geopolitical sense, as I've been mentioning other countries and nations. Trump is already saying Venezuela is surrounded, even though it's not an island. So what's he actually surrounding? May go a whole lot farther south. Escalation around Venezuela is a very serious matter that may affect the entire continent and even the U.S. itself. Argentine international relations expert Tadeo Castiglione warned, quote, "I believe no one fully grasps the scale of the situation." Oh, I hear you, Mr. Castiglione. Crickets behind a woodshed. Attempting to ignite conflict in Venezuela is akin to detonating a power keg, he said, given the possible dire consequences the global South, including Russia, China, and Iran, tried to mitigate the U.S. statement's effect, he added. The threat of a naval blockade against Venezuela aligns with the U.S. internal economic interests and its strategy to pressure China, the expert concluded. And remember, Maduro already offered the U.S. oil and gold monopolies. So it appears like it isn't about drugs. It's not only about natural resources. I suppose once a criminal, always a criminal. Declaring a government of Venezuela terrorist organization would allow the United States to conduct targeted attacks on the nation's soil to eliminate its leader, which would be the crossing the Rubicon, he told Sputnik. And I don't agree the declaration justifies and allows the U.S. to strike at all. And CIA business as usual isn't actually crossing the Rubicon now. Beyond that, if the U.S. thought it was wronged when Venezuela nationalized its oil industry 50 years ago, as I mentioned earlier, almost to the year now, in 1976 it started, Venezuela created a state-owned company, PDVSA, ending direct foreign ownership of oil reserves while still allowing international companies to operate under service contracts. And the U.S. had the opportunity to bring the claim to a court of competent jurisdiction, but didn't have a right to just commit war crimes, piracy, and plunder 50 years later. But if we go down that path, disregarding the lack of principle or right for the moment, what stops the U.S. from going after every country that nationalized its resources that affected a U.S. company, such as Bolivia and Mexico? Sound familiar? Or what about Algeria? No, not too interesting. Well, how about North Korea, Iran, Russia? Sound more familiar now? Trump isn't interested in peace. The only peace Trump is interested in is the peace the literal Teflon Don gangster can steal from somebody. And he said, whatever it takes. Remember? It's the peace he can get away with taking. And barring a come-to-Jesus moment, you, my fellow natives, watch what he takes from you at home as you watch and continue watching. because people have lost the sense God gave to a box of rocks, and I don't mean to insult a box of rocks or any rock in the box. As I'm attempting in the broadcast to show you, just go to property law, you can see what's going on. There's a reflection of international law in our own laws, and the laws that are there to protect us and the grants and all that for land are there, and they are violated by people like Trump. He's not the only one. He just happened to be the current one. And if they're willing to do it to you at home, which they are, that's why everyone complains about their property taxes, don't know the first thing about what's going on. But President Trump will come and give you what you can grasp, and he's going to go do it out there because he can get away with it. But until I see the one that's being trespassed is shown to not have what their country, not have their land, not have their right to their resources, and it's a mirror facing back, then why would we be able to say we have any of ours? But if I get to it at the very end, we might find out maybe we don't. And it depends on how you set up what your position is. Right now, just coming with the military and destroying things and threatening is not normally the way you want to do it. And if you agree with that, then you're saying you want to live in that world where it can be done to you. And in a way, you're already living that way, but you don't know it. This is where I'm talking about Genghis Khan's horde knocking on your door, asking you for a cup of tea. Pentagon weighs major shakeup at U.S. command. So right on cue of the shakeups, the chaos, and what's coming down, proposals would cut combatant commands, elevate New America's international hubs. The Pentagon is weighing one of the biggest command shakeups in decades, a move that would trim top brass and rewire how U.S. forces are run around the world. Remember, I talked about this in a couple of episodes consistently in series about the reorganization, the rebranding is what's being done right now under Trump. They're fine-tuning this oppressive government. According to the Washington Post sources, a draft proposal prepared by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who sought a consolidation of commands, would fold three of the military's most prominent regional headquarters, U.S. Central Command, European Command, and Africa Command, into a new umbrella organization called U.S. International Command. And I want you to pay attention to how they're doing this and what they're doing and where that new security document they just published is and what they're moving from and moving to. And you're going to see it starts to align with this. And then I said earlier in the broadcast on a couple of content pieces, as they are diminishing, as an empire is diminishing, and they're now reaching out around them. Listen to what Trump has done north and south, and we're hearing that consolidation as well here. The plan would also merge U.S. Northern Command and Southern Command into U.S. America's Command, or AmeriCom, overseeing missions across the Western Hemisphere. The changes would cut the number of combatant commands from 11 to 8, and reduce how many four-star commanders report directly to Hegseth. Indo-Pacific, Cyber, Special Operations, Space, Strategic, and Transportation Command will remain separate. The proposal, developed by the Pentagon's joint staff under Chairman General Dan Kane, Kane, tracks with the Trump administration's stated goal of shifting resources away from Europe and the Middle East and focusing more on the Americas. Hegseth's office declined to discuss what it called, quote, rumored internal discussions, close quote, but insisted there is no internal rift over the effort. Well, I don't know why there would be. But you're hearing, as I've been discussing it, this has happening now. This is the command structure is being adjusted to what I said looked like it was moving to. At least in part. The Post sources say members of the Senate and House Armed Services Committee are perturbed by the Pentagon's failure to share details of the plan with Congress. Lawmakers have ordered the Pentagon to submit a detailed cost and impact assessment, including effects on alliances that are blocking funding for the reorganization until 60 days after they receive it. Again, sounds as I suggested in some of the past episodes. AmeriCom focuses military on the shrinking backyard and likely for regime change, piracy, and booty call plunder on the land. And if this next report is true, there is something seriously wrong with this administration and dementia or loss of coherent reality, but more likely the admission of guilt of a criminal gang. U.S. demands ICC rewrite rules to shield Trump. Officials in Washington reportedly fear the court could target the president and others in his administration after 2029. Now, first off, why would the United States, so-called, ask an organization it doesn't recognize, the ICC, and of which it's not a member, to change its rules to exclude an officer from justice, or in particular, one doing peaceful works? Why? And then, why does it think ICC should make a special rule, or would, or exclude anyone? Or being the United States purports to have their "you can't touch this, get out of jail free" justification in their undisclosed murder memo, used to justify extrajudicial, extraterritorial executions and global mayhem. Why? Washington is pressuring. That's a thug strong-arming, isn't it? The International Criminal Court to amend its founding statute to block any attempt to prosecute the United States President Trump or his senior officials. The ICC was created in 2002 under the Rome Statute to prosecute genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. So far, 125 countries have ratified the treaty and are full members of the court. However, major global powers, including Russia, China, India, the U.S., and Israel, major global power here, Israel, have either not signed or not ratified the agreement. The administration fears the court could move against Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of War Pete Fogg Between the Ears, Hegseth, and others after Trump leaves office in 2029, according to one senior official. The source did not specify which issues might trigger prosecution, but insisted that the Rome Statute must be amended to state explicitly that the ICC has no jurisdiction to pursue them. If the tribunal refuses to act, Washington may sanction the ICC as an institution, severely disrupting its operations, the outlet claimed. Future ICC investigations may include the U.S. military campaign in the Caribbean and off the Pacific coast of South America, where American forces have carried out deadly strikes at suspected drug-running vessels, killing more than 80 people. It's now, quickly, how quickly this is working. Well, it's over 100 now. But they have the murder memo, don't they? Just like Obama did, right? Nobody went after Obama, not even his own jurisdiction. And we, the people, were also quite fine with that, apparently. And the U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, has described the court as a national security threat that has been an instrument of a lawfare against the United States and Israel. So what is the admission here in the demand, so-called? This is BTWRLM 659. And getting back over to what happens when you start doing sanctions against natural resource production, another example and evidence of what happens in the world, confirming what might be happening globally now. Russia oil unscathed as West sanctions on Rosneft, Lukoil fall flat. Western sanctions against Russia energy plants, Rosneft and Lukoil, have had no impact on oil production in Russia, the Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said on Wednesday. Quote, we see daily figures that show no decline in production. In fact, overall output is slightly higher than the previous month, so no adjustments are needed now. When asked whether sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft had an impact on oil production in the country, Novak added that he anticipates the discount on Russian oil will begin to decline in the next couple of months as the market adapts to a new round of sanctions. Wholesale fuel prices in Russia are falling amid export restrictions and increased production after refineries complete maintenance, Russian Deputy Prime Minister Novak said on Wednesday. Well, firstly, we have stopped exporting. Secondly, we are experiencing a seasonal decline in demand. Thirdly, the factories are coming out of maintenance, meaning production volumes are increasing. The Russian fuel market is stable, and the recent reduction in wholesale prices is now being passed on to consumers at gas stations, the official clarified. Russia is leaving its 2025 oil production forecast unchanged at 510 million tons. Yes, the forecasts are not changed. Russia produced oil below its OPEC plus quota by about 70,000 barrels per day in October. Production is rising. We expect the rate to increase to be higher in November than it was in October. However, based on the growth rate relative to our quotas, I estimate a shortfall of about 70,000 barrels in October. This is due to our model, which incorporates both inertial growth and inertial reduction. So it's our model. Russia must already be using state-controlled AI to protect its sovereignty. What do you think? Think we're going to get at them? Their AI is accurate? So far, it sounds like it is. Their model's been working. They're not hurt. When asked if Russia is fulfilling its quoted OPEC plus deal and increasing oil production, in October, Russia fully completed the compensation for previously allowed overproduction, and now it will focus only on quotas. Russia will reach its OPEC plus oil production level either by the end of 2025 or early 2026, depending on the companies. So, as I've been saying since the opening economic salvo was fired at Russia by Biden, sanctions are losers. The U.S. lost the hybrid Ukraine war in the opening shot. Trump's a loser because he isn't savvy enough to have figured out that sanctions didn't and wouldn't work, and so absent or a part of the system that he imposed his own. Nor is Trump independent nor intelligent enough to escape Biden's blunder or Biden's Congress's domestic economic disaster planned for Americans, which was kicked down the road by the Republican Party until January, while they blamed the part of the unit party called the Democrats, just as they and Trump blame the Democrats for the hoax Epstein Files fiasco to continue the planned economic and political destruction of America. Fancy that. It's something that the sanctions of law didn't seem to control, and likely aren't. We'll revisit, since this is now a big deal this week, the Epstein Files being dumped, and not lawfully so, only parts of it are. We'll see what happens with that, too. I think I'm more interested to watch how the government fumbles things around and whether or not it could ever get anything done. Maybe we'll just, over time here, finally rid people of the idea that the government does any good at all, and maybe we can get on the path we need to get. Let's raise up the issue here, the idea and how we're being interfered with and influenced through Jeffrey Epstein. And the question and the articles have been going on and on and on about something. It caught my attention. I wanted to keep on this a little bit, just to keep track. In a way, I'm really not interested, but it's important, and I guess that's another problem. Things can be important, but not interesting. And I guess the non-interest is that there's really no performance of, again, sanctions in the negative, where there's accountability. We're not seeing it. Jeffrey Epstein and the Mossad, how the sex trafficker helped Israel build a back channel to Russia amid Syrian civil war. And with all this geopolitical stuff going on, we watch players in the system, whether we knew them or not, he seems to have risen to the top, so we get to watch it. Now we get to see things will be exposed to us. Again, I'm hoping there's a lot of interest in some people maybe that are really interested to do this, to take this, all the information they're going to find, and derive things from this that we can potentially use or understand to be applied maybe in the future. Hopefully the government's going to step up, but, you know, I'm not going to hold my breath. But Jeffrey Epstein facilitated efforts to open a back channel between Israel and the Kremlin during a Syrian civil war, according to leaked emails from former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. The trove of emails exchanged at the height of the Syrian civil war between 2013 and 2016 reveal Epstein's successful efforts to secure private meetings between Barak and Russian President Vladimir Putin to discuss a Russia-brokered end to the conflict, including winning Russian support for a negotiated removal of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Epstein was an invaluable resource for Israel's former prime minister, who also served as the head of intelligence and defense minister throughout his career, sharing whispers from within Russia elite circles and intel on Putin's interlocutors in Europe and the U.S., and even advising him on how to engage with the Mossad, Barak, fresh out of his role as Israeli defense minister, built a deep portfolio of investments and business relations around the world with Epstein's help. Now, because the reoccurring argument is whether Epstein worked for Mossad, and because many particular statements in this and in the other article that I'm going to touch in a moment suggest such, I wondered whether there was an answer to that, even if circumstantial. Did Epstein work for Mossad? And after discussion with my friend, our friend of the network, whom I felt has a better working handle on these international intrigues and analysis, and with the clarification of what the terms working for, agent, and then applying the reference that Epstein was apolitical in context of what that meant, a general concurrence was derived, which I'll speak to from my thoughts, leaving the other remaining to a possible ongoing research of much deeper yet known global endeavors bringing about the future that they want. Why this becomes integral for my interests, not necessarily the scandalous part, which is serious, damning, and not good, but that's kind of like gone now. So we're now looking at, how did this guy come along? Did he come along? Who was he working for? But I think on the ongoing research, follow the money would sum up that continuing analysis. I'm thinking trying to answer whether Epstein worked for Mossad is a misdirection, pigeonholing the discussion away from other possibilities and fodder for trolls. Epstein didn't need to officially work for Mossad to do its bidding. He also didn't need to represent himself in any way to do his own or the bidding of others, especially after he has street cred. He was an instrumental character, period. His main achievements were financial, which gets him close to the politics of influence, intimately. Epstein was just another of many integral agents of the vampire squid towards the fast approaching global transformation, which does intersect Israel and their minion and the many other things here that I've pointed out behind the woodshed episode after episode. So I don't know that following someone along this thing, he works for Mossad. Oh, there's Mossad. There's Israel. No, this is an issue. This is a much grander thing going on. I don't necessarily think grander and better. So with all that cross-sector entanglementability in mind, we find Jeffrey Epstein helped broker Israeli security agreement also with Mongolia. Jeffrey Epstein used his political network and financial resources to help broker a security cooperation agreement between the governments of Israel and Mongolia, according to a trove of leaked emails from former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak. This is a set of emails between Barak and Epstein has largely been ignored by the mainstream press, but includes a crucial new context of Epstein's operation. It's well known that Epstein had personal ties to Israel, including the senior political officials like Barak and Ehud Olmert, and that he donated to organizations like Friends of the IDF. But Epstein's activities in Mongolia show for the first time that he facilitated a deal that led to a security agreement between Israel and other nations. The leaked emails were released by Handala, a pro-Palestinian hacking group which speculated ties to Iran. The documents were posted by Distributed Denial of Secrets, a nonprofit whistleblower and file-sharing website. Although the emails lack cryptographic signatures, they contain a vast amount of unpublished private photographs and documents from Barak and his inner circle, including information that was not publicly known at the time. Messages spanning from 2013 to 2016 show intimate, oftentimes daily correspondence between Barak and Epstein. Their conversations address political and business strategy as Epstein coordinated meetings for Barak with other members of his elite circle. In 2008, Epstein pled guilty to charges of procuring a minor for prostitution. The Barack has denied knowledge of Epstein's sexual trafficking and abuse of minors, and this article is the first in a series that will explore the Epstein's work on behalf of Israeli military interests, particularly as it relates to his role in the development of Israel's cyber warfare industry. And again, we were an official who's paid or as an agent or a free agent. The point being that he was instrumental. Don't get buried in whether or not Mossad was involved. He worked, and we now have evidence that he did work for the state of Israel as well as others. The rise of Israel's cyber surveillance and weapons industry has been one of the most significant geopolitical developments of the past two decades, making sophisticated hacking tools available as turnkey packages to police and military around the world. Our problem now. In the shadows of Israel's cyber boom was Jeffrey Epstein, who exploited his network of political and financial elites to help Barack, and ultimately the Israeli government itself, to increase the penetration of Israel's spy tech firms into foreign countries. And I want to highlight here, it was the political and financial elites to help. And then, ultimately, the Israeli government. So Epstein's a character placed a little differently now here. Epstein actively supported the Israeli intelligence industry via venture capital investment and contributions to charitable organizations, non-governmental entities that laid the foundation for official Israeli security deal-making. The stories of Israel's 2017 security agreement with Mongolia is a window into the true nature and scope of Epstein's operations. Again, it's bigger then I think we're being guided if we let that happen. And as a reminder, when we go to the follow the money, the vampire squid, how Chase Bank executives aided Epstein and funneled his money despite staff concerns about the pedophile. A new investigation reveals how Jeffrey Epstein worked with J.P. Morgan Chase while carrying out his sex trafficking operation. J.P. Morgan Chase, one of the world's top banks, worked with Epstein from the late 1990s to until 2013, even as employees raised concerns about him. And Epstein died by suicide in a New York City jail in 2019 while facing federal sex trafficking charges, so says this article. That J.P. Morgan Chase processed more than 4,700 transactions for Epstein, which totaled more than $1.1 billion, Bravo dollars, and included payments to his victims. But what was the FBI on that one? It wasn't until 2019 that J.P. Morgan opened an internal investigation called Project Jeep and filed a report with the federal regulators retroactively flagging these transactions as suspicious, according to the outlet. J.P. Morgan had to pay billions of dollars in market manipulation as well, but continued that manipulation after. In October 2020, he paid $955 million to settle civil and criminal charges for market manipulation involving fake trades in precious metals and U.S. treasuries. So follow me as we go now and transition here. J.P. Morgan, precious metals, manipulation. Epstein involved long time back. And also a reminder, Jeffrey Epstein referred Obama White House counsel to J.P. Morgan as potential customer. And again, he's the go-between here. He's not really being the agent involved in that this one either. And I'm just bringing these things up to, I want to lift maybe a release this idea. We have to identify he did anything in particular for anybody in particular. He did it all. He did all that. He set it up. He had the people that would do it. He understood how people were wired and how to exploit them. Very successful at what he did. Sex predator Jeffrey Epstein was involved in establishing a client relationship between Obama White House counsel Catherine Rumler and J.P. Morgan Chase in February 2019, 4 months before he was arrested on federal child sex trafficking charges. A new court filing revealed that Rumler, who is now general counsel for Goldman Sachs, was touted by Epstein's personal assistant to J.P. Morgan as a would-be customer, the filing shows. The suggestion that J.P. Morgan take Roemmler on as a client, which the bank warmly embraced, came almost 6 years after J.P. Morgan said it had effectively fired Epstein as a client after repeated red flags being raised about him for years internally at the bank. And it came 5 months before Epstein didn't kill himself in August of 2019 in a Manhattan federal jail where he was being held without bail pending trial. And another connected financier, and who has not killed himself, coincidentally, despite wanting you dead, BlackRock's puppet master, Larry Fink's tokenization and depopulation agenda. And stick with me as I seemingly diverge a bit, but we're going to bring these right back together. Keep track of the bankers in these, and we will get together on the other side of this. Larry Fink, BlackRock CEO, the world's largest asset manager, about $13.5 trillion tango dollars, isn't just in finance. He's reshaping how money, markets, and political influence work. Here's how his vision favors centralized capital power. Tokenization equals influence tool. Well, that's what they say on this post. I don't think tokenization is merely for influence. Yes, there is influence in the promotion, fast, efficient, cheaper, safe, and effective. Remember that? Yeah, they can influence the adoption, but fast, efficient, cheaper, safe, and effective isn't the function, the purpose, or utility of tokenization, nor of whom owns and controls that digital servitude, slavery, Siberian gulag, however regulated. Tokenization is a whole lot more, so don't get lulled by that minimalistic characterization in this. Fink has openly declared that we are just at the beginning of the tokenization of all assets, from stocks and bonds to real estate, positioning digital tokens as the future of finance. See, it isn't mere influence that tokenization is, despite this author suggesting so. Right, you mentally tokenized citizens already among us? Oh, what would you know? Who am I asking? And he didn't mention the planned tokenization of people, did he? BlackRock already runs one of the largest Bitcoin ETFs, above $100 billion, and the tokenized money market fund. He claims tokenization will democratize investing and revolutionize markets, moving trillions sitting in digital wallets into traditional products. In reality, the agenda is way darker. A closed financial ecosystem where everything you own could be tracked as a token on a ledger controlled by a handful of giants like BlackRock. Online commentators warn this could extend to digital identities and economic behavior. The market leader and political power broker, Fink regularly engages with policymakers and regulators from Washington to Brussels, shaping economic policy, regulatory frameworks, and the future of finance. Such access gives BlackRock leverage far beyond the typical corporate actors. He's publicly voiced concerns about rising populism and social media scrutiny, telling leaders they have to be more guarded in what they say. And so let's keep a track on this one, because I get to the other tab, we're going to find out an integration coming with social media scrutiny, even more down in encompassing the platforms and their integration. A rhetorical move some interpret as a pressure on democratic discourse. BlackRock's policy stances, like ESG and climate strategies, have directly influenced government and corporate agendas, drawing backlash from both conservative and progressive factions. The hidden agenda. Critics view Fink as a population control advocate or part of the Great Reset elite. BlackRock can own houses, identities, and even your life via tokenization, a distortion of legitimate debate over financial centralization versus personal freedom. Why it matters. BlackRock's financial scale, political access, and drive towards tokenization markets aren't abstract theories. They're reshaping the infrastructure of global capitalism. Fink's language about tokenization and guarded leadership isn't just business speak. to critics, it's a blueprint for expanding control and influence over markets and public policy. Larry Fink isn't merely an investor. He's a strategist turning financial dominance into geopolitical power with tokenization as the next frontier in control. And in one regard, to go through that, I don't know how Epstein was any different. They're transcending Mossad, if I can say it that way. As we watch the tokenization begin to appear in the world, another post-tokenization or takeover, Pakistan, falls into the globalist crypto trap. So let's get that connected up. Tokenization is crypto now. It's that Bitcoin. It just hasn't been attached yet. Pakistan signed a Memorandum of Understanding, an MOU, with Binance to explore the tokenization of up to $2 billion Bravo dollars in sovereign assets, including government bonds, treasury bills, and commodity reserves such as oil, gas, and metals, all aimed at boosting liquidity and attracting investors. The newly established Pakistan Virtual Assets Regulatory Authority has already granted preliminary clearance to Binance and HTX to set up regulated local entities and begin preparations for full exchange licenses. But beneath the glossy language of innovation and financial inclusion and digital transformation lies a far more consequential reality. Listen, folks. Listen to Buck's fine one shit here. Tokenization is actually a tool for global financial restructuring, experts say. When sovereign bonds, natural resources, and public assets are converted into digital tokens, they become easier to trade, fractionalize, and ultimately externalize. Control subtle shifts away from national institutions towards transnational platforms, supranational standards, and financial architectures designed elsewhere. Regulatory bodies like IOSCO warn that the tokenization can create spillover effects with crypto markets, increasing counterparty risks and exposing gaps in investor protection. European regulators such as ESMA highlight that the tokenized financial products may not confer traditional legal rights, creating potential for investors' misunderstanding and market integrity issues. You have no traditional property rights, then you'll like it. The involvement of Binance in global financial powerhouse underscores the trend. What is framed as a partnership may in practice resemble dependency. It's worse than that. Siberian gulag, folks. You're dependent, all right. While pitched as a stabilizing instrument for debt and investor confidence, tokenized instruments and stable coins often serve as on-ramps into global liquidity systems, tying domestic monetary policy and external expectations and reducing policy flexibility rather than enhancing it. This shift is framed as an urgent act now or be left behind, echoing decades of structural adjustment programs, privatization waves, and financial liberalization across the global south. Blockchain is just the new interface. The rapid creation of PBARA and the fast tracking of licenses for global exchanges suggest that Pakistan is not cautiously experimenting. What did Trump just do here? It is restructuring its financial sovereignty to fit a predefined global model. Assets are liquid, borders are porous for capital, and decision-making gravitates upward and outward. Pakistan's digital turn should be read less as a technological breakthrough and more as a geopolitical alignment. Okay, parity, folks, right into that system. It's already there. Tokenization may promise efficiency, but it risks locking the country deeper into systems it does not control. History shows that when reforms are externally driven and rushed internally, sovereignty is often the first casualty, even when the language is modern and the code is new. Without strong institutional safeguards, tokenization could expose Pakistan to volatile global capital flows, policy constraints, in external pressure rather than in delivering a true economic autonomy. then once you get digitized, you might as well forget it. I don't know how you break free of them. Putin advisor claims the U.S. using stablecoin gold to devalue its $37 trillion debt. It's not like 38, almost going 39 now, just in the time of this article. An advisor to Russia President Vladimir Putin said the U.S. is strategically using crypto and gold to devalue its debt to urgently address the declining trust in the dollar. Listen very carefully here, as this is another type, one of those giving us an idea of how this thing is moving along. The U.S. is now trying to rewrite the rules of the gold and cryptocurrency markets. Remember the size of their debt, $35 trillion. As I said, it's now over 38. These two sectors, crypto and gold, are essentially alternatives to the traditional global currency system, Anton Gobryakov said at a press briefing on Monday at the Eastern Economic Forum in Vladivostok, Russia. Quote, as in the 1930s and the 1970s, the U.S. plans to solve its financial problems at the world's expense, this time by pushing everyone into crypto cloud. This would involve Washington moving its debt into U.S. dollar stablecoins to devalue it, allowing the U.S. to start from scratch, Sobolyakov said, without explaining how stablecoins could actually devalue the debt. There is a ton of speculation in this, but I mention it because we don't know what the they intend nor how the they intend to pull it off. And so we want to hear this. We want to watch. It really isn't about the devaluation either. There's a control coming, right? And there's the inclusion coming globally here. But we do have someone else looking into this and listen to what pops up as we move this thing along. How stable coins became America's secret weapon for managing the $35 trillion debt. Russia just accused the United States of using crypto to wipe its $35 trillion in debt. While it does sound like the usual propaganda, once you dig into it, there's actually some merit there. Most people think that of stablecoins like Tether, a USDT, or Circle's USDC as simple crypto payment tools, fast, cheap, and global money transfers. What they don't know is that under the hood, every new stablecoin minted corresponds with the U.S. Treasuries to back it. It's the only way to generate yield per the Genius Act, G-E-N-I-U-S Act, which was signed into law this July. This means stablecoins are massive and growing buyer of government debt. How big? Tether alone holds roughly $127 billion, bravo dollars, in the United States Treasuries, more than South Korea and Saudi Arabia. That makes it the 17th largest T-bill holder globally. Well, Tether, the same company investing money with Rumble, the supposed free speech platform that won't allow the speech from behind the woodshed or reallibertymedia.com. Now over 210 accounts are gone, I'm told. And did you hear that the comrades Trump Media and Technology Group and TAE Technologies, a premier fusion company which is backed by Alphabet's Google and oil major Chevron, plan to merge in an all-stock transaction valued at more than $6 billion, the Bravo dollars? How did they value Truth Social anywhere close to that when it's losing money hand over fist? Just sounds like these free speech platforms are gearing up to be AI powerhouses to capture and tokenize the unwary. Every dollar of stablecoin supply is a new marginal buyer of American debt. The Genius Act, with the full encouragement of the U.S. administration, is going to rapidly and massively increase USD stablecoins proliferation and circulation. This is also some pretty bad news to most countries who have weaker currencies than the United States. The stablecoin milkshake theory, a U.S. Treasury-backed token that settles globally in seconds, is already a better dollar. But add yield and you create something nuclear, a self-directed migration of deposits from weak currencies into synthetic dollars that earn more than local banks ever can. If you're in Argentina, Nigeria, or Turkey, why hold pesos, naira, or lira? Why even hold dollar deposits at the local bank? Stable coins are safer, more liquid, and higher yielding. and they move without permission. So is Russia correct? While the U.S. is not wiping out the $35 trillion debt, the administration has engineered a beautiful way to monetize the debt, exporting the USD not as a store of value or risk-free assessment, but as a technological superior global instantaneous money. The bottom line remains, stable coins are becoming a critical gear in America's debt engine. Enforcing the move to tokenization, impulsive, learned hopelessness, America's Weimar moment, what DoorDash culture says about economic decline. When the future becomes unaffordable and savings become pointless, a $30 poke bowl makes complete sense. A Reddit thread appeared recently in which a man posed the question of where kids in America are getting the money to live a DoorDash lifestyle. DoorDash is one of the several smartphone apps in the U.S. that deliver restaurant meals to your door for a steep premium. The thread went viral but was subsequently deleted for reasons that are unclear to me, though many screenshots exist. The post was from a 44-year-old man with no kids, quote, "I own and operate a fast casual restaurant with 4 locations. I'm intimately familiar with the insane amount of money it costs to have food delivered to your door. At my restaurant, a $16 poke bowl delivered with tip is going to run you close to $30. Now let's call that Jacob's restaurant. For someone making 6 figures, sure, I have it. But trust me when I tell you, almost every high school age kid these days seems to use DoorDash multiple times a week. This thread got ping-ponged around on X, and one user jumped in with an explanation that caught my eye. This is the author speaking. Quote, "They're behaving like people living in a post-middle-class economy where ownership is unattainable, savings are pointless, buying a home is impossible, and upward mobility is gone. So what happens?" Yeah, what happens? Despite an inherent knowing, how does youthful ignorance respond? They shift to a present maximization mindset. If the future is unaffordable anyway, why not buy the burrito now? Younger people are not reckless. They are rational inside a broken incentive system. Burrito? Wouldn't that be the whole enchilada? Besides that, listen to the explanation. Gen Z is rational inside, but in a broken system. But their youthful ignorance responds how? By staying in the broken system, but harder. Luke Groman, one of today's most incisive financial analysts, chimed in, "Watch the movie Cabaret. The youth in Weimar Germany behave similarly." So this youthful ignorance is replicated. It's how they expect us to respond, and we will. Very interesting. And Grimner, the founder of Real Liberty Media, would have been all over this story, being he long reminded people this is where the economy was headed, the Weimar Republic problem. But I don't think Gen Z was listening too close. I'll explain better in a moment as I read through some more of the foundation for the answer, if you haven't picked up enough on the values already to know it. For most of the post-war period, saving money made sense. A young person or family would convert savings into a down payment and pay it off gradually thanks to a stable and reliable job. There was a direct connection between the ability of middle-class goodies that one sought. This rewarded discipline and delayed gratification, and it also attested to people's optimistic view of the prospects of stability. This world is a shattered and broken. What this points to is a disconnect between the wealth that can be generated by earning hourly wages, working the gig economy, or relying on sporadic Venmo transfer from family members, and what can be generated by holding assets such as the real estate that nobody can afford. These two parallel tracks are diverging more and more as the real economy diverges from the financialized paper economy, soon to be tokenized. So listen carefully here. The divergence of the real economy with this financialized paper. Can you say divergence from fiat economy? I knew you could. And consider what I've explained to follow the example of the nations and their instrumentalities, and by that for us to get into honest money to address the real economy. From the article, we still benchmark everything to the dollar. However, because the dollar as a store of value is being debauched faster than an ordinary person can earn dollars through labor, the path to success lies in asset ownership and not in simply earning marginally more dollars. The repeating success is in asset ownership, not in fiat, aka dollars. In the current American economy, it is asset ownership that matters. Parenthetically, or a very high wages in an industry in the business of an asset ownership. Accordingly, Gen Zers correctly identified $30 as not being worth much more than a poke bowl. And I had to look up what that was. Poke. Some of you may know. Maybe some of you are Gen Z. Maybe some of you do this. But therein lies Gen Z's mistake. Equating bucks with a bowl of pottage from Jacob's restaurant, in this case, a home-delivered bowl of poke, giving up something more valuable and outside of the prison gruel. For a good comparison, in 17th century England, historians estimate that a beer and ale could account for as much as 10 to 25% of a laborer's cash outlays. This wasn't because England was populated by inveterate drunks or fantastically irresponsible people, but because there was no point in saving the marginal unit of money in a rigid hierarchical system in which the barriers to true social advancement were too high. DoorDash culture is the digital version of that. So Gen Z, for all their insight, have one foot in the digital gulag grave. Well, let's look at that prior statement more closely. There was no point in saving the marginal unit of money. No value in saving up fiat. But what else might there have been to save, incrementally, week by week? If this sounds a bit like feudalism, it is because that's exactly what it is. King Trump sound familiar in this regard? Or more precisely, it's a hybrid of feudalism and the type of pre-Weimar attachment that arises when wages don't match prices, the currency is being debauched, and the future is profoundly uncertain and ominous. We are exactly at that point, except the feudalism of today isn't recognizable to us. Elites protect their assets via political capture, while the rest of society pays rents rather than shares in growth. In medieval feudalism, power was decentralized, sound like crypto. Nobles had their own justice system, militias, and taxes. And when you get into that crypto system, that third party holding your tokens and their gold is going to be that rule. Today, corporations and asset holders function like mini sovereigns. Hedge funds and private equity control housing and employment structures. The list goes on. However, this is not the feudalism of the Arthurian legends that can exist in a state of bucolic stasis for centuries. This version is perched up precariously on a highly financialized economy that itself is kept afloat by unsustainable debt levels. It is a system that is both highly unstable and quite rigid at the same time, however paradoxically that sounds, and Gen Z senses both sides of that equation. This is where feudalism meets Weimar Germany. But how different are things really? In the rearview mirror of the dynamic post-war decades, now we've settled into a system where the elites own the scarce assets while everyone else pays ever more in participation costs while securing less ownership. And finally, we get to the literal money quote, and not different in substance than you've heard behind the woodshed all these years broadcasting. Quote, perpetually rising asset values are a perfect defense against those rising participation costs. If that is, you're fortunate enough to be part of the asset-owning class. Well, how do you like that? Now, what have I been hearing but that the elites and central banks and investment banks are all going to gold and silver to give you tokens? JP Morgan just went long and physical in silver, if the reports are correct. This BIS-affiliated global banker stopped shorting silver completely. The central banks are sucking up gold. Basel III makes gold money again. Not America great again. Basel III kicking in last July, as I reported just before then and again, as highlighted by Edward Dowd last episode. This then says, go to gold and silver. Asset prices are always rising because the system is designed to prioritize preserving balance sheet stability. Markets are always too big to fail, and a disorderly decline in asset prices is treated as a systemic emergency requiring intervention. But this means that losses are socialized on the downside, whereas gains remain private. The result? Asset prices trend upward over time, almost by definition. Almost by definition. This has always been the fact, notwithstanding the market fixing and manipulation. So stop playing in the casino and notice asset prices trend upward. They at least keep pace, but fiat does not. DoorDash culture points to the psychological preconditions of the world that can quickly turn very inflationary. Spending money because saving it is pointless is a self-fulfilling prophecy. So instead of getting into their own doom spiral, what should Gen Z be doing other than buying a DoorDash-delivered bowl of poke? It would be to learn you how to cut and slice vittles into a bowl and make you a chef salad at home, wouldn't it? You take that excess, everything above the cost of delivery, at the very least, and buy silver with it, week by week. And had you been doing that when I made it a point to tell you, if you was listening then, when silver was around $20 an ounce, look at the value it would have been now and likely increasing. And then you keep buying and waiting and watching. And when the correction happens, then look at your silver wealth, likely more valuable than where that bowl of poke is headed, what Kohler toilets will tell you all about. And with the wealth that you think is valueless, when you just bought that bowl of poke with the delivery cost, you capitalize on the real estate, if that's what you desire, at the time of the correction. You claw yourself back week by week, non-delivered bowl by non-delivery, to get what your wardens want to take from you, your self-determination. Those 30-buck bowls of poke become silver money each week instead because you learned to cut some veggies, cheese, and meats for yourself and made your monetary freedom more important than the profits to DoorDash or Jacob's Restaurant in the broken marginal unit system imprisoning you. And if there is nothing you're going to buy with the profits you would volunteer to donate to DoorDash at the time of the correction of the economy, then keep storing your wealth, which by definition trends upwards until you're able to escape the neo-feudalism of the day. To put it bluntly, central banks and governments guarantee that asset prices stay ahead of inflation, an updated form of the old noble privileges dished out by the medieval kings. We can extend this analogy. Power is tied to control finite resources, not so much land, but financial claims. This is where it gets a little bit dicey to me, but land is not necessarily power relative to money, but possessing land is a practical place to lay your head at night and begin each day to provide for yourself, further removing you from the marginal unit of the Borg. You're not part of the debt system that requires the making of financial claims. You have assets and pay for what you need. Trending upward, there's no inflation. You pass equal the value to those providing for the needs you can't provide for yourself. And honest money is merely the medium of that exchange, not the chains of a perpetual debt-based servitude causing you to think that bucks for bowls of pottage or poke, as it were today, instead of claiming your birthright and inheritance. And maybe this corollary isn't just for Gen Z either. And to get over, and as I was reporting about J.P. Morgan's morphing, evolving due to man-made dynamics, J.P. Morgan sells entire 200 million ounce silver short position flips long 750 million ounces. J.P. Morgan, long believed to be the largest short of gold and silver markets, are allegedly at the behest of the U.S. government, reportedly has closed the entire 200 million ounce naked short silver position and flipped long 750 million ounces, the largest physical silver stockpile in the world. JPM's move coincided with the U.S. Mint announcing a shortage of silver coins. The shocking Economic Times report explains why silver has finally been unleashed after decades of suppression. We have always known that J.P. Morgan would flip long when the end game finally arrived for silver manipulation. Well, there are some problems with this story, like how do you sell a short position? You should be coughing up some cash there, but those problems aside, if this is true, realize that maybe at the behest of the United States government, physical silver can be tokenized. And this is, to me, the big deal when I was talking about the tokenization, talking about the end game, talking about where the financial system comes, the Epsteins of the world, the Finks of the world. They're all pulling it in, and now we're seeing the movement toward assets, while Gen Z and lots of others likely are living the DoorDash culture, or even if you don't do that, you're not putting your money into assets. Now, we've just got the explanation about why that works that way. Survival of the fittest, J.P. Morgan is nothing on nature due to man-made dynamics. When students vanished during the pandemic from University of California, Los Angeles, the beaks on its campus songbirds quietly morphed. The remarkable findings come from a new study in the PNAS, which is the first to document a pandemic-related change in the physical form of a wild animal group. It describes how dark-eyed juncos, who first adapted to urban life in Los Angeles, soon adopted shorter wings and beaks, possibly in response to diet changes. Gen Z, am I hearing you here? Adapt. Rather than dining on seeds and insects as usual, these urban birds instead found bread, cookies, and dropped pizza. But chicks hatched in 2021 and 2022 after classrooms emptied and dining halls closed developed longer, slimmer beaks, more like their wildland counterparts. By 2023 and 2024, with students and their leftovers back, the stockier urban beak shape returned. Quote, "We were really shocked," co-author of the UCLA evolutionary biologist Pamela Yeh tells The Times. "Both the speed of the change and the reversibility are equally surprising," an outside expert tells Spain Science Media Center. Researchers say that they can't prove the exact cause, but the leading explanation is rapid natural selection tied to food. With human scraps suddenly scarce, birds better adapted to eating natural fare may have been more likely to survive and breed, passing on wild-style beaks to the next generation. An alternative idea that shy forest juncos moved onto the quiet campus and interbred with city birds is considered less likely based on the field data. The work is part of a broader look at the so-called anthropause, when global lockdowns offered an unplanned experiment in animal behavior. Earlier studies documented quieter songbirds and bolder movements by species like mountain lions and sea turtles as humans were largely confined to their homes, and shamefully so. None of them had to do that. You've heard me for years talk about how that was avoidable. The findings underscore how tightly human activity is woven into nearby ecosystems. I wonder if that's going to be a digital ecosystem. How about Gen Z? Pizzas and crumbs and crust, and how swiftly wildlife can adjust to our presence or absence. But they just can't say the word, can they? They insist, trust the science. UCLA evolutionary biologists insist it's evolution. It's just what Darwin explained. Not evolution, it's adaptation. And here is the evidence it happens in one generation. No evolution either. They are still dark-eyed juncos. Imagine that. So I wonder how short the beaks and other appendages of All those baby humans that hatched after their mothers and fathers consumed all that bread, cookies, and pizza in this DoorDash culture we're moving into. This has been BTWRLM 659. I'll be with you next week. Tech tips, or nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, piercing free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, lessons to learn. Dose by dose, behind the woodshed, no stone unturned.
Next week, heed the call, behind the woodshed standing tall.